tomorrow when it will be the anniversary of Donald Trump's second inauguration. I wonder what we'll talk about. Next up on Times Radio, Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thank you, Andrew. Very good afternoon. It's 2 o'clock. You're listening to Jane and Fee on Times Radio.
And in the next couple of hours, we'll have the latest on the high-speed rail crash in Spain. It's thought 39 people have lost their lives. The British Prime Minister says Greenland belongs to Greenland and not the United States. We'll talk to a former US ambassador. Vladimir Putin isn't really known for being a peacemaker exactly, but according to the Kremlin, he has been invited onto the Gaza Peace Board. Russia expert Mark Galliotti will tell us what attributes Mr. Putin might bring to that role. And have you ever wondered, and we certainly had, what Henry IV of France sounds like? Well, you're going to find out in about 20 minutes, thanks to French scientists and some incredibly clever technology.
And all of that is going to happen after the very latest news with Stuart Willey.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Sir Keir Starmer says he doesn't think Donald Trump is serious about taking military action in Greenland. The Prime Minister's criticised the President's threat of 10% tariffs if Denmark and other European allies don't allow him to take over the island. Reform UK leader Nigel Farage says he wants America to have a successful economic partnership with Greenland, but thinks upping trade taxes for the UK is wrong.
I'm all for Trump taking out enemies of the West, but if he falls out with his own allies and leaves America isolated, that would be a very bad place to be. So I'm worried about it. I'm concerned about it. I've always been a supporter of the president, but I will be having some words with the American administration in Davos on Wednesday.
Meanwhile, in a letter to Norway's Prime Minister, President Trump has linked his push for control of Greenland to the failure to award him the Nobel Peace Prize. European leaders are warning that the threats to 8 members of NATO could have consequences for the alliance. Oana Lungescu is a former NATO spokeswoman, now with the think tank RUSI. She told Times Radio this is a serious crisis.
Just as the United States remain crucial for the defence of Europe, including of the UK, Europe is also absolutely crucial to the defence of the United States. It's through the North Atlantic that Russian nuclear submarines and indeed intercontinental missiles from Russia would go to the American mainland.
The Kremlin says Donald Trump has invited Vladimir Putin to join the Board of Peace in Gaza. The president will chair the board, which will oversee a new administrative body. Sir Tony Blair is among those already who have been invited to join. There's to be 3 days of mourning in Spain following a high-speed train crash that's left at least 39 people dead. 150 others were injured when a service from Malaga to Madrid derailed last night, smashing into another train coming in the opposite direction. Heavy machinery is at the scene this afternoon. Rescuers expect to find more victims. The Duke of Sussex has been watching proceedings at the Royal Courts of Justice as the hearing in his case against Associated Newspapers begins. He and 6 other claimants, including Sir Elton John, Sadie Frost and Liz Hurley, accuse the Daily Mail publishers of phone hacking and blagging personal information. Associated Newspapers denies the allegations. The Sunday Times Royal Editor Roya Nicker says Prince Harry and the King will not meet during this visit.
He's not going to see his father on this trip. That has been made very clear from a long time ago because his father is currently up in Scotland, still on his winter break, although he is doing engagements this week. King's very keen not to be seen as sort of involved in any way in this litigation. So he won't see him on this trip. If he comes back in the summer, as I reported last week, he will. That's another matter, and he may.
And UK growth is predicted to be faster than most other G7 countries next year, behind only the US and Canada. The International Monetary Fund expects the total value of Britain's output, or GDP, to sit at 1.5% next year. That's unchanged from its last report. For a roundup of the news on demand, subscribe to the Times Radio News Briefing on any podcast platform.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the Times Radio app, online, and on your smart speaker.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wickes Kitchens and Bathrooms.
That is us, and it's 4 minutes past two. Welcome to another week. Welcome to Monday and yet another day where international law looks like a thin raincoat being worn in a storm. President Donald J. Trump has informed Greenland that he intends to start the actions needed to make it a part of America. He's done it via a letter to the Norwegian leader. How can that be okay? Our Prime Minister has stood up to say, nope, tariffs are not the way to react to friends when you don't get your way, citing how much damage they would do to our economy. But our question for you this afternoon, where does all of this leave your head? We're going to try to make sense of the cat's cradle of international politics going on in front of us. And on a completely different tip, and you're absolutely allowed for this to be the story that you really look forward to this afternoon, what did Henry IV sound like? Using science and the gentleman's mummified head. Thank you for laughing.
Sweet of you to say gentleman. By the way, we need to emphasise the French Henry IV.
Yes, you're bien sûr, you are right. We're going to hear a little bit of what the French Henry IV sounded like, and we're going to pit him against the English Richard III, because his voice was also recreated through technology. What fun times we've had in the production office today. Are you so frustrated with the performance of the water companies that you would consider taking their bosses on physically? We talked to one woman who specialises in the citizens' arrest method of protest. And after three, we will also talk about what an amendment in the Hillsborough Law will mean for the security services. Surely there comes a time when they do have to comply to the same rules of evidence giving in the event of a tragedy as the rest of us. We will also do books with Alex, money with Adam, and then it's home time for us.
Okay, it's tax return with Adam today. So if that's just sort of hovering, it's somewhere in the back of your mind and you're actually quite happy on the quiet to keep it there, you'd have to do it. You've got to do it. So Adam will tell us how to do it, who needs to do it at around about 3:45 this
Swallow
afternoon.
The frog.
Yeah, just go there.
Do it.
You'll feel much better afterwards. What are the most read stories on the Times website?
In at number three shark attacks in 24 hours as Sydney boy 13 fights for life. Scientists say swimmers are at a greater risk because of the effect of the warming climate on the Australian city's sea temperatures. The second most read story today, Putin has been asked to join Trump Gaza Board of Peace. Russia says it's studying the proposal, while the UK says it has severe reservations about joining the board, which could cost countries $1 billion to be a member. We're going to talk about that with Mark Galliotti soon. And the most read piece on the Times website, no surprise, Trump Greenland latest. US President not serious about invasion, says Starmer. That is the Times' live page. You can get all of the very latest updates as soon as something happens, as soon as something is said, it goes up on that live page. You can read it on thetimes.com. You do need your digital subscription. Well worth it at the moment. If you don't have one, get one. You can go to thetimes.com/subscribe.
And you can join in on WhatsApp. We love hearing from you. 0333 003 2353. It's Jane and Fee. We're here on Times Radio until 4 this afternoon. Now, at least 39 people have died in a high-speed train collision in southern Spain. Dozens more have been hurt in what is the country's worst rail crash in over a decade. Now, it happened after the tail end of a Madrid-bound train derailed and crashed into an oncoming train in Adamuz yesterday. Rescue efforts are ongoing. The Spanish Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez has announced 3 days of mourning. And here he is, Mr. Sanchez, pledging full transparency in the investigation into the crash. He's speaking with a translator a little earlier.
The Spanish people, like any people, will be asking themselves questions. What has happened? How has it happened? How has it been possible that this tragedy has unfolded? Time and the work done by the specialists and the technicians will bring the answers. And this is another feeling I'd like to convey to the Spanish people, that we will get to the truth, we will find the answers, and as soon as we have those answers and we understand what has caused this tragedy, We will inform you clearly and in full transparency.
The words of the Spanish Prime Minister. Railway expert and historian Christian Woolmar joins us now. There's a great deal of, well, incredulity, really, about this crash, Christian, because I understand at least one of the trains involved was incredibly new. The track was quite new and had recently been inspected. What do you read into all that?
Well, this is an unprecedented crash because essentially in the kind of 60-year history of high-speed trains, there have been some incidents, but most of these have involved trains that were not running at full speed or trains that were not on high-speed sections. And here, uniquely, it seems to be that this train was in a high-speed section. It was running at full speed. It was carrying passengers. And for some reason, it derailed. Now, the most obvious reason for the derailment is that there was a broken rail. As you say, there was inspections. There would be inspections regularly to ensure there aren't any faults. The fact that it happened at the rear end of the train may suggest that it was a faulty rail that actually then snapped on the beginning part of the train and therefore caused the derailment. It was also very unlucky that there was a train on the other tracks that it then kind of smashed into. It will be some time before investigators actually ascertain the full reason. But I am surprised that this happened on a straight section of track. And therefore, I would have thought that the investigators would already be focusing on the condition of the track.
Can you just actually define for us what a derailment means? I'm never entirely sure. Does it mean moves off the train, the rail track, or goes onto another track? What exactly is it?
No, it just means that it comes off the rails, right? So trains follow two rails all the way through, and a derailment means that one or more wheels have come off the track, and obviously, given that the rails are set a space apart, 4 foot 8.5 in this case, then the other part of the other wheels come off, and therefore the train is then running on the ballast and then can run off into, particularly if there's a bend, into the surrounding area. And that's what will cause death and injuries.
Right, I see. So it's part of this tragedy, and it is a tragedy, that there was another train on the other part of the track. And that's why so many people have lost their lives.
Yes, that's absolutely right. If you remember, a few weeks ago, we had a derailment of a train at Shap, which is the big incline in Cumbria on the West Coast Main Line. And that happened on a straight section of track. The train ended in what's called the forefoot, which is actually the gap between the up rail and the down tracks. And there was absolutely no injuries. I think there was one very minor injury, but there was no major casualties because it didn't meet a track coming in the other a train coming in the other direction, and because it stayed upright because it was a straight section of track. So this might not have been a disaster at all had it not been for the fact that there was the train coming on in the other direction.
Now, it's already been told, we've already been told, that human error has been ruled out. How can they be so certain?
I don't know what that means.
Right.
I mean, I think they mean possibly that, they didn't go through a signal. These trains are not actually signalled externally. They have kind of internal signalling systems. They operated, the signalling comes through a radio beacons. But I think they mean by that, it didn't go for a red signal. Well, there aren't kind of, it's not signaling the same way. The train, if it was going too fast for the signaling, it would be slowed down or stopped automatically. Of course, there might be human error involved. There might be a failure to maintain the track properly. There might be something wrong with the train, although, yes, it was a newish train, but that doesn't mean that it was maintained 100%. There might be something that went wrong with the wheels. There was an accident with a train running quite fast about 25 years ago in Germany, a place called Enschede, and that was caused by the fact that they changed the type of wheel they were using, and the wheel kind of disintegrated, or what's called the tire, the outside bit of the wheel, came off, and it derailed at a bridge. It smashed into the bridge and killed more than 100 people. So, I don't think that that's a sensible statement to make, because in the German crash, they found very much that there'd been a whole series of human errors that had led to this wheel shedding the outer tire and causing it to be derailed.
Now, I should really have asked this earlier, but just how fast is Spanish high-speed rail travel? Is it significantly faster than our own?
Well, we don't have any high-speed lines apart from the line down to the Channel Tunnel, which is 300 kilometres an hour, and that's pretty the same that is running in Spain. I think this section might have been a slightly slower section, but essentially it's 300 kilometres an hour is the standard speed of most high-speed trains around the world. I mean, I've just written a book called Fast Track, which is coming out in June, and looked at systems across the world. And essentially 300 kilometres or 320 kilometres an hour is what they've been aiming at so far. There is a lot of intent to go up to 350 and even 400 kilometres an hour in some places like China and Japan. But broadly at the moment, the standard speed for high-speed rail is 300 kilometres per hour, which is 186 miles per hour. It's pretty fast.
Yeah, I mean, is it just too crude to say that the faster the train, the more dangerous the trip?
No, that's not correct, because it's all about maintenance. It's all about the capability of the trains. It's all about the design of the trains. Look, this is and I should have emphasized this earlier, this is a fantastically safe means of travel, right? There are literally thousands of high-speed trains running in Japan, China, France, Germany, Spain, Italy, every day, running at these speeds, very fast, and not having accidents. They're safer than conventional services because they tend not to share the tracks with slower trains. They're maintained and designed to very high standards. So this is a fantastically safe means of transport, and that makes this tragedy all the more unfortunate. It is, as I said, really the first time a train traveling at high speed on dedicated tracks has ever crashed with multiple fatalities in the world. All the other accidents have been had slightly different circumstances behind them. So this is a major tragedy on what is a very safe form of transport.
Right. And I'm very glad that you emphasised that. There was a terrible accident in Greece 2 or 3 years ago. I think a lot of young people died. It was students going back to university after the holidays, I think. And there's a court case pending there, isn't there?
But that was essentially caused by the signalling error, which sent trains heading towards each other at quite high speed. But this was on an old line. It was poor maintenance, poor operation practice that contributed to that. And there was indeed considerable anger and protests by the parents of the young people killed and by other survivors. As you say, yes, there is a court case running at the moment, but that is a completely different circumstance. That was an old traditional line with traditional signalling, and human error was entirely responsible for it.
OK, thank you very much for coming on. That's Christian Woolmer, railway historian and expert.
So it is always interesting to listen to the statistics around rail travel, isn't it? And actually, I'm absolutely of a like mind to yours, Jane, and thinking that 300 kilometres an hour is just an astonishingly fast pace. Fast. But then you do have to just measure that fear, don't you, with fact, which is what Christian was saying, is it doesn't mean the faster the train, the more likely an accident. In fact, far from it.
No. It's interesting, though, isn't it? And it's just that, obviously, there are road crashes every day, and we probably don't examine them closely enough, do we? We don't think about them. But a train crash, wherever it is in the world, does grab the headlines and makes people perhaps unnecessarily worried.
Yeah, this is one with a huge number of fatalities, though. You want to talk about geopolitics this afternoon so far on the text. This one comes in from Jeff, who says, listening to Starmer's truly pathetic response to Trump's outrageous demands, it underscores for me how adrift we are as a nation. Without the courage or wherewithal to move decisively one way or the other, a good prime minister would realise this and take us firmly back into the European family and end this lost decade as soon as possible. Andy is finding it simply difficult to cope with the thought that this is the first year of the presidency. We have three more years of this. I think my head will explode. Andy, stay with us. We'll try and contain that for you. And that's certainly what we're going to do with our next item, which will delight Cherie, who doesn't, in fact, want to hear the voices of our previous leaders. She says, let them lie. We're obsessed with delivery. She's not bothered. Mm. What of Abraham Lincoln? Sounds like some hillbilly. Well, his brilliant speeches come across differently. Well, we're going to listen to a French king, so it's kind of okay.
Yeah, no, it's French, so that's fine. I'd love to have heard what Boudicca sounded like, for example. Can you imagine?
So let's try and compare. In your imagination, who do you think Boudicca does sound like?
Well, she was from the kind of, was she from the Norfolk area? So she might have sounded a bit like that.
It's okay.
I'm not attempting to go. What was her tribe? The Iceni.
The Iceni.
Yeah, Iceni. Yeah. I think it is the North. That area?
Yeah.
Not the North, but,
no,
you know.
But she was big on the East Coast,
Anglia,
wasn't she?
Yeah, yes. East Coast, yeah.
Yeah.
If someone can perhaps send us a little, their own interpretation of what they think Boudicca would have sounded like.
Yep. So maybe she too resided in Clacton for a little while.
She could have done.
Yep. We were musing on the fact that in my head, for some reason, I always think that Anne Boleyn sounds like Denise Van Outen. We'll take some comparisons. It's Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wickes. The kitchen and bathroom sale is now on. You can explore all the sale offers at Wickes.co.uk, or you can visit your local Wickes store.
Tomorrow marks 1 year since the beginning of Donald Trump's second presidency, and Times Radio will bring you extensive coverage throughout the day, including Andrew Neil on the Times at 1 live from New York. Hear expert analysis of where the Trump presidency is heading next with the Times team of writers and columnists in the US, including Katie Balls, Lara Spirit and David Charter. Trump, 1 year on, throughout the day tomorrow on Times Radio.
Here's the truth about AI. AI is only as powerful as the platform it's built into. ServiceNow puts AI to work for people across your business, removing friction and frustration for your employees, supercharging productivity for your developers, providing intelligent tools for your service agents to make customers happier. All built into a single platform you can use right now. That's why the world works with ServiceNow. Visit servicenow.com/UK/AI for people.
I thought I'd seen it all, then felt myself awaken. I thought I'd witnessed beauty before my breath was taken. I thought that I'd known wonder, then sailed beneath these skies. I thought I'd seen the world until I opened my eyes. Change the way you see the world with HX Expeditions. Search Travel HX to discover more.
Listen to Times Radio at 6:30 every weekday morning for your indispensable briefing on the latest politics, business and sports news of the day.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wickes. Let Wickes install your new kitchen. Choose from a wide range of kitchens and add the option of installation to your order. For complete peace of mind, all installations include a 2-year workmanship guarantee. Get started by booking a free design appointment at wickes.co.uk.
Here we go. Let's have some fun. Over in France, scientists have reconstructed the voice of King Henry IV using his mummified head. A 3D model of the sovereign's skull has been used to create the initial vocal capsule, which gives us an idea of how the monarch would have sounded. Écoutez, everybody. Okay, Okay, so Jane and I were told by the producer today not to listen to that until we came into the studio. So,
it's the dinner party guest from hell, isn't it?
I just wonder what he's doing.
Well, let's not wonder too much.
Let's talk to Charles Bremner, Times contributor, who joins us now. Very good afternoon, Charles.
Good afternoon.
Now, what do you make of this voice?
It's quite fun. It's just this is done by Philippe Charlier, who's a very well-known forensic pathologist at the University of Versailles. He's made a speciality out of recreating anatomically dead French presidents in some form, one form or another. He's worked with an interdisciplinary team to create what they claim is a reproduction of the phonetic structure of the body of King Henry IV. King Henry IV was one of the much loved French kings. He was the parallel to Queen Elizabeth of England at the end of the 16th century. So this has attracted a lot of interest. And the scientific team thinks that they can now turn to other experts and actually recreate voice, speech, and even going as far as the king's southwestern accent, to have him read out text that he wrote in his lifetime.
Right, OK. Well, look, this is nice work if you can get it, Charles. but I mean, in a sense, what's the point? Because also we just don't know whether or not these very clever academic people have got it right. I mean, how would you or I ever challenge that?
Well, they do admit that there's no way of proving them wrong. But they say that they're much more precise than previous attempts to do this sort of thing. You might remember the London University did it with an Egyptian mummy, and some other academics have done it with the Mona Lisa, although there was nobody concerned in that one. These scientists say that they have such detail of the structure of Henry IV's body, or his head at least, and his neck, that they can come up with a pretty accurate reconstruction using very modern techniques. And this gives, and they've gone as far as blowing air through the reproduced head with all the vocal cords as they must have been, as they claim. So they say this is as close as anybody could get to imagining what the tone of his voice sounded like.
Right. Now, my ears pricked up at the Mona Lisa. I mean, have you had a chance ever to listen to what that recreation of her voice was like?
No, that was done a few years ago by people just imagining the developing from the structure of her head, right, and facial features, what that would have sounded like.
Okay. We were having a little bit of fun, Charles, and just imagining who in our minds, just in our imagination, the dead figures of history might sound like in the modern day. So I thought that perhaps Anne Boleyn would sound a little bit like Denise Van Outen. I don't know whether you're familiar with Denise's work. We've had a fantastic suggestion from Mary, who thinks that Boudicca might have sounded like Kathy Burke. Do you have a relevant French person living who you could compare Henry IV's voice to?
Well, the obvious one is the politician called François Bayrou, who was the prime minister for briefly last year. He is a big figure in the southwest Béarn. He's the mayor of Pau, which is the birthplace of Henry IV. And he has this accent of the Pyrenees, which Henry IV had. And François Bayrou likes to see himself as a modern-day Henry IV, so he would be the one I think I would.
Okay. Now, we did hear the voice of King Richard III, the English king, after his face was rebuilt in 2024. Shall we have a listen to this and compare the two gentlemen?
We're therefore following in the footsteps of our ancestors. I've determined to honour our dearest firstborn son, Edward, whose outstanding qualities with which he is singularly endued for his age, give great.
Well, he's got more about him than the French. Exactly.
We're at the beginning of a journey here, aren't we, with Henry IV. But, Charles, is the idea that actually these academics and technicians and scientists will be able to get to the kind of speech that the same type of people got to with King Richard?
Yes, absolutely. They want to reproduce the accent and everything and have the king read out, for instance, one of his love letters to his mistress at the time. And that's, of course, a French procedure, standard French procedure. But But what they claim more seriously, much more seriously, is that this all this work will help in the reconstruction of speech for patients who've had cancer treatment and removal of their larynx and other medical treatments like that. So they say this is all very serious and positive. It is not just playing around with history.
OK, well, we completely, obviously, applaud that. Are French people excited, though, by being able to hear the possibility of a long-dead king?
Well, so far, just that one or two vowels, not really, no.
A few Gallic shrugs.
It was replayed with a lot of excitement by Radio France, the equivalent to BBC, but it did produce quite a lot of shrugs because it didn't impress a lot.
Yeah. Thank you very much indeed for bringing us this story today. That's Charles Bremner. I think one last time, and I'll tell you what we might do. We might compare it to one of the best words that we ever heard pronounced in a French accent on this programme just a couple of weeks ago. So I don't know whether Rutland will be able to find the flabby. That's Henry the Fourth, French king, of course. Anne says...
Flabby?
Flabby. Thank you. Let's have another. Thank you. Not everyone's enjoying it. Anne just says, this is nonsense, ladies. Move on. And Jan has gone early with the Margaret Thatcher klaxon. I'm no big fan of Thatcher's politics, but my goodness, I think I'd like her in charge right now, says Jan. Fair enough. I mean, I do sometimes entertain myself, actually, Jan, with thoughts of how Margaret Thatcher would deal with Donald Trump. I think somehow she might be... She might have been capable of...
It would be quite a meeting of some things, wouldn't
yes,
it?
Yes, it really would. It really, really would. And Ush points out, Boudicca was an early Briton and would have spoken a language very close to Welsh. Mm. Yeah, my rookie error there.
Yeah.
Oh, and this is horrible history. You won't get far with Boudicca. Bowman, Yeoman, smash the Roman foeman, all say yah. Yah! Yeah, she didn't take any prisoners.
That's just so different to how we learnt history.
Yes, she did take prisoners, actually, at some point.
She literally did.
No longer with us.
Right, so that's some of the finest radio that Jane Garvey and I have ever produced, and thankfully it is now over.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
Good afternoon. With the headlines on Times Radio, I'm Stuart Willey. The Prime Minister is calling for calm discussion about Donald Trump's desire to take over Greenland. That's despite the US President's threat of tariffs on European countries opposed to his aim. 3 days of official mourning are to be observed in Spain after a high-speed rail crash. 39 people are known to have died and more than 150 injured after a service from Malaga to Madrid derailed and hit a train travelling in the opposite direction. Prince Harry sat beside Liz Hurley, Sadie Frost and the former MP Sir Simon Hughes in court earlier as the case against the Daily Mail's publisher was outlined. Associated Newspapers denies unlawful information gathering. Sir Keir Starmer says the government is taking time to get the Hillsborough law right. It's after it pulled a debate due today following a backlash from campaigners and MPs. The Times chief reporter is Sean O'Neill.
Yes, it is a victory in campaigners. They've pushed back quite heavily. They had a meeting with Starmer last week on this very issue. Their concern is that the security services will be given a get out from this duty of candor. Or how do you maintain sort of national security and secrecy around intelligence services with a duty of transparency? It's a bit of a knot that nobody seems to be able to untangle at the moment.
And a finger prick blood test could replace the current invasive and expensive ways we diagnose Alzheimer's. It's being trialled and works by picking up three proteins known to be associated with the disease. Don't forget, you can set the Times Radio News Briefing as your news service on Alexa.
This is Times Radio.
Romantic retreats, luxury beachfront hotels, expansive family villas with sensational sea views. Not lots of. Just the very best of. Simpson Travel. The magical destinations you love. The personal service you expect. We visit every one of our properties so we can handpick the perfect holiday for you. SimpsonTravel.com. Because your time is precious.
Hi, just leaving work now. Sorry it's a bit loud. Basically, so I was thinking we could get Mackey's tonight. Had a Big Mac on my mind all day and delivery fee on the app is now from 99p. So, you in? Of course you are. Love you. Bye.
exclusively on the McDonald's app. 18 plus. Service fee and small order fee may apply. Participating restaurants. Serving times and T's and C's apply.
Get a first look at tomorrow morning's front pages. Tonight from 10 with Carol Walker on Times Radio.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix. Ready to start planning your new kitchen or bathroom? If you'd like a personalised design, the Wix free design service can guide you through the whole process, including a free home measure. Book today at wix.co.uk.
Good afternoon, it's Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio until 4. Vijay's a bit worried, Fee. He says he knows it's Monday, but I'm not sure what's going on. Have you two been inhaling something? Or is it a bit too much hairspray? Well, we should say that you've got a bad back, haven't you?
I have taken quite a lot of over-the-counter drugs, actually, Vijay. So maybe it's showing. But also, we just wanted to do something for 7 minutes that wasn't about the impending doom facing the world.
Yes.
And that's what we alighted on.
Yes.
So it was either that or the extraordinary scenes at the Africa Cup of Nations, which I don't think had done very many favours to the world of football.
Well,
so,
OK, let's bring in John Pino. I was trying to explain to my less than interested colleagues about the Panenka a little earlier on.
Yeah.
This is the dinky penalty that misfired last night horribly. Would you have had the brass neck to do one of those in that situation?
I mean, anyone who asked me to do take a penalty in any situation needs their head examined. I do know what it's like being a fan and watching players take dodgy, clever penalties.
Mm.
And in the run-up, the stop-start penalty, all those things.
Stuttering.
Every time you feel yourself saying in your head or out loud, what are you doing?
Exactly.
And when it does not go in, well, then the world can hear your screams, you know. So I know where that comes from.
Yeah, it was so miserable for that poor bloke last night. I did feel sorry for him, but then it was very, very stupid to do it at that moment. Anyway,
if you're
not aware of what we're talking about, you'll be bored stiff. John, what have you got on the programme between 4 o'clock and 7?
We're talking about the continually unfolding crisis, which is now, you know, a yawning economic crisis, which is a strategic crisis, which is a rift in the Western Alliance, is opening up before us in the most horrible way. And we heard Keir Starmer this morning, didn't we? Just treading this really fine line, just avoiding trying to ramp up the volume. Doesn't want to make a bad situation worse and not threatening counter-sanctions if we're hit with all the other NATO members with sanctions. And you can understand that, I suggest, if you compare the NATO members' relationship to Donald Trump and his administration to an irrational, abusive relationship. And I think that's a reasonable comparison. It feels very much as if we on our side are trapped in an abusive relationship. And how do you deal with that? Well, I guess against that context, you can make an argument for treading very, very carefully and not making it worse. But if it comes to the point where the blows start landing heavily and threatening your survival, well, then speaking softly doesn't cut it anymore. And at that point, does Keir Starmer then make the call to go for it and join in what would then be, as it were, economic combat with the USA? Because to fail to do that, I suggest, would look like a betrayal. It would look like leaving everyone else in this partnership to twist in the wind while Britain goes its own way, maybe even tries to cut a side deal, which would look, wouldn't it, just tawdry beyond belief. So we're going to talk all of that through, where we are at the moment. And that's very rational, by the way. Donald Trump saying that being denied a Nobel Peace Prize should be linked to him going after Greenland. If that's not irrational, then what on earth is rational? I mean, I'm talking to Karen von Hippel, formerly of the State Department, a real expert, Fabrice Potier, former Director of Policy Planning at NATO, the former head of the Foreign Office, Simon Fraser's joining me, and so is the Cabinet Minister, Douglas Alexander. So I've got plenty of people to hash it out with.
Thank you very much indeed. I just want to mention that we have had, sometimes we do get messages, we need to be clear about this, in support of our somewhat, let's be honest, beleaguered Prime Minister Sir Keir Starmer. And Nigel says, I think he's got a lot of faults, but when it comes to foreign affairs and diplomacy, I'm grateful that Keir is our Prime Minister at the moment. Bajanok, Davy, Polanski, etc. would probably change their rhetoric if they were in his shoes. I think his tact and awareness of the bigger picture is vital to our, and indeed our allies' security. So there we go. He doesn't, I mean, in the words of Donald Trump, perhaps our Prime Minister doesn't have many cards, but he's playing the cards he's got as deftly as he can.
And I think we have to recognise as well, don't we, that it almost doesn't matter what our Prime Minister is saying to us if, in fact, what he can say to Trump makes a difference? I mean, there is so much grandstanding around the world in reaction to what President Trump says, but if it doesn't do anything to change President Trump's mind, what's the point of the noise that it's making? So you got to hope that somewhere along the line there is a little kindling log that is about to be lit to revive that special relationship. And what we might think of what's being said to us, might just have to hold our breath a bit.
Well, if you want to chip in on this one, because it is really interesting, 0333 003 2353. Let's talk more about the geopolitical situation. And this is an interesting one. Vladimir Putin has been invited to be part of Donald Trump's peace board for Gaza, apparently. That news comes from the Kremlin, which says the Russian leader is thinking about it. He's studying the proposal. Now, other members already include, we know, Tony Blair, US Secretary of State Marco Rubio, and the leaders of Canada, Egypt, Argentina and Turkey. The Times reports that the UK does have reservations about joining, with permanent membership costing nations a cool $1 billion each. Mark Galeotti is an expert on Russian security affairs and director of the MIAC Intelligence Consultancy. Mark, first of all, are you surprised that Vladimir Putin has been invited to join?
Yeah, it does seem rather surreal, though, let's be perfectly honest, these days the surreal is the norm. But on the other hand, I can absolutely see the rationale from Trump's point of view, in that on a logical level, one could say, well, Putin's involvement would actually help balance out this notional border peace. And on a rather more mercenary level, well, if Putin's willing to stump up $1 billion, I'm sure Trump regards his money as good as anyone else's. But in the current circumstances of the war in Ukraine, to have Putin on any kind of a peace board does seem truly bizarre.
Yes. Do we know where this $1 billion goes?
Well, it's never been tell. In theory, I mean, it's not going into Trump's pocket, although it's not directly. No, the idea is, as I understand it, that this money then becomes sort of a kitty at the disposal of the Council of Peace to be able to oversee the reconstruction of Gaza and all these other wonderful projects. Now, if we look at what's happened already in Venezuela, where the first contract for oil has gone to one of President Trump's cronies, and what might well happen in Greenland, a cynic would suggest that actually a lot of this would be parceled out to Trump's friends, his campaign finances, and so forth. But at least the idea is that this money would be used for the reconstruction of the region.
Right. And is there perhaps thinking at some level that if you get Putin inside the tent, sitting permanently on this board of peace, then, I mean, is it naive to think he might behave better?
Well, I mean, it's not as though Russia's presence on the UN Security Council seems to have been a particularly moderating impact. It may well be. I mean, as I say, I think one thing that the Russians have done under Trump, which they didn't do under Biden, is very much compartmentalise their relationship. So they can say, well, this is what we're doing about Ukraine, but that doesn't necessarily have to bleed out to issues of, you know, economic cooperation or nuclear proliferation or the like. So in theory, Putin could, one could imagine, play some kind of a positive role here. But the degree to which the, if nothing else, just the optics of not only abandoning the attempts to isolate Putin, which weren't really working, but actually to invite him onto this top table, so long as he's willing to pony up the $1 billion, I mean, that certainly would make it very, very difficult to sustain the line that, in fact, Russia is beyond the pale at the moment and needs to be kept in international, on the international naughty step.
Right. And would other members of the board be happy to sit there alongside Putin then?
Well, I mean, obviously it depends on who ends up on the board. I mean, we understand, and again, none of this has been confirmed, but that President Lukashenko of Belarus, one of Putin's closest allies, but also a dictator who has been heavily sanctioned by the West, has also been invited. So, I mean, I think that the members of the board who, shall we say, are Western affiliated might well have trouble. The danger is, of course, that the kind of regime which is willing to stump up the $1 billion for a permanent seat, remember, you can be on temporarily on a sort of bargain plan, might well be actually the kind of more authoritarian type regimes which definitely are not friendly to the West. So, yes, well, we'll have to wait and see quite what kind of a company Tony Blair ends up finding himself
yes,
in.
Yes, I mean, it's just all very bizarre. I mean, is the long-term aim just to take on the UN?
I mean, look, you're asking me to crawl into the recesses of Trump's mind, which is hardly a fair ask. Look, it's very hard to know, and it's frankly hard to know even if this border peace, as currently envisaged, is even really going to actually sort of take off and become a meaningful entity. Certainly, if it happens, what it means is in some ways Donald Trump is indeed creating yet another alternative world order. We've already got, in some ways, the Chinese constructing their own parallel to and in opposition with the sort of the Western dominated one. Now we actually see Trump creating his own, in which he will be in bed with a whole variety of deeply unpleasant and anti-democratic forces. So yes, if it's either an alternative UN, or at the very least, it's a massive means of undermining the UN, which we know Trump mistrusts.
Right. I mean, and just going back to Gaza, which is where it started, has the word Gaza now been removed from the title of the Board of Peace, by the way?
Well, yeah, it does seem to be. Again, we see so many different iterations. It does seem to be, which is, again, another warning sign that this may well be, in Trump's mind or the mind of the people around him, at least envisaged as something that becomes something bigger than just a very, very specific response to a particular terrible crisis, but instead, as you say, a kind of alternative security council or something similar. Because if it is a generic border peace, what's to stop Trump then saying, and this will also be involved with Ukraine, for example?
And just explain what influence, if any, Putin has on, for example, Netanyahu. Are they relatively close?
They're actually quite close personal friends, and in some ways this was an issue which the Russians were very annoyed about, that, you know, when the terrible Hamas attacks on Israel took place. At that point, Russia was still quite dependent on Iran for missiles and drones. This was the early stage of their war in Ukraine. And therefore, in a way, they had to go along with Iran, they had to side with Hamas, and in the process burn a lot of their relationship with Israel. The Russians are actually quite keen to get that back. They've always regarded their relationship with Israel as actually quite a useful one in the Middle East, a counterweight to countries like Iran. And you know, I think from Netanyahu himself, who is also quite internationally beleaguered, he would quite like to feel that the Russians are, even if quietly, also on side. So, you know, we're going to see all kinds of what might seem sort of strange, perverse alliances and relationships being sort of played out in the whole Gaza peace process, insofar as it works.
Yes, I mean, it's absolutely fascinating and incredibly confusing. And you, for the people of Gaza, you do wonder whether peace is actually any closer. What do you think?
Well, look, I mean, I think peace is always something that was actually going to be resolved by the issues on the ground. And in some ways, both sides are beginning to actually have to accept that they are reaching a point of exhaustion. And it's usually exhaustion that ends these kind of conflicts more than anything else. The big question is, you might say, whether actually the opinions of the people on the ground get ignored now in the process, that they actually just simply get swallowed up in these grand geopolitical bargains being taking place. So, you know, if the people of Gaza don't really have a say, yes, they may have some kind of peace, they may well have some kind of redevelopment, but the stake, which is going to be absolutely crucial for making sure that they don't find themselves once again, at least some of them, turning to terrorist tactics, that sense of a stake in their own future, that's not going to be very clear.
And I'm sorry for my slightly sort of scattergun approach, but there's just so many questions that I want to ask about this incredibly complicated situation on planet Earth right now. What does Putin make of Trump's endless references to Russia and China being interested in Greenland? I mean, is Russia interested?
Yeah, I mean, the Russians are loving this. And interestingly, Putin himself actually came out with a kind of little... He does tend to think of himself as a sort of historian, Monquet, even though he's a very bad historian. But he came out with a little sort of historical rationale for why actually America has some kind of a claim to Greenland. But from their point of view, Greenland matters because obviously this is a route not just for their shipping, but also for their submarines. But they don't really think that an American invasion, conquest, buy up, whatever it is, would really change the situation on the ground. But the prospect of a Western alliance that is tearing itself apart, and even if they manage to get past this particular crisis, even if Trump is talked down, the legacy of mistrust is something that is going to last for a long time. So if, you're, for example, you're looking at the Russian media at the moment, they are absolutely loving this.
Thank you. Mark Galeotti, who's an expert on Russian security affairs.
Now, coming up, if your company fails the public, should you face a citizen's arrest? You're listening to Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wix, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms.
Times Radio Breakfast with Nationwide. Start your day with Times Radio's essential morning briefing. With intelligent conversation and incisive analysis from some of the most respected names in politics, culture and entertainment. Hear well-informed opinion and quality journalism on all the big stories making the headlines. Times Radio Breakfast, tomorrow morning from 6, with Nationwide, a good way to bank.
Listen to Times Radio on your smart speaker. Just say, play Times Radio.
It turns out you can please all of the people, all of the time. Garden games for the kids, a separate cottage for the grandparents, a private chef for that special occasion. Simpson Travel, idyllic Mediterranean holidays that everyone will love. We take care of the details so you can enjoy the moment. SimpsonTravel.com, because your time is precious.
Hear that? It's your big McDonald's hunger calling, because the Big Arch is back. And this time, it's here to stay. With juicy beef, cheddar cheese, and that Big Arch sauce. Hungry? You are now. Order delivery on the McDonald's app. Serve from 11 a.m. Upcharges and fees apply to delivery orders. Subject to availability, price and participation may vary.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
It's just coming up to 10 minutes to 3. Picture this, you're doing your daily commute and all of a sudden you find yourself enclosed in a circle of strangers placing you under a citizen's arrest. Well, if you're the big boss of a water company, the chances are this is your experience. Last year, there were 12 attempted arrests of water industry executives by a group called the Citizens Arrest Network, including Mark Thurston from Anglian Water and Southern Water's Lawrence Gosden. Well, Isabel Rock is a climate activist who's been taking part in the arrests, and she joins us now. Isabel, talk us through what the letter of the law is regarding making a citizen's arrest.
So we do have a right to make a citizen's arrest. Usually it's used when there's been a mugging or a stabbing or some sort of like street crime, and it's used to detain the person until the police can get there. And however, we are exercising our right to make a citizen's arrest. And the charge is public nuisance, which is an indictable offence and carries a prison sentence of 10 years. And we believe that these the CEOs and the people in charge of these massive companies causing huge pollution should be held to account and are a public nuisance.
In the arrests that you have been a part of making, how many of those have then led to a charge?
So we have, just in the past week or so, we've been working with Lee Day Law Firm, and we have handed over a dossier of evidence to Thames Valley Police outlining charges against Chris Weston, and we have asked the police to investigate, and it's over to them now to carry on.
Right, and remind our audience who Chris Weston is.
He's the CEO of Thames Water.
OK. So many people listening will be customers of certainly those three companies that I've mentioned, Anglian Water, Southern Water. People are in crisis, aren't they, in Southern Water's territory and Thames Water. And I'm sure everybody understands the frustration of being that customer. But not everybody would feel so frustrated that they would take the action that you're taking. So On whose behalf do you have permission to do this?
Well, there is a lot of public support for this. And I would say these are our beaches, these are our rivers, and this is our drinking water. And I have a niece and nephew. I want them to have clean drinking water. I want them to be able to swim in the sea. We all deserve that. We all have that right. And these companies are spoiling that right. So I feel a responsibility towards the next generation and towards everybody. And if and all of Citizens Arrest Network have that sort of same feeling of responsibility.
Yeah, some of the responses that we've witnessed of late from the water company bosses have been so parlous, haven't they, Isabel? I wonder what the response is in the moment when you're actually making a citizen's arrest.
They are annoyed, they are inconvenienced, they're understandably irritated. However, I feel that this is for the people who've got sick from drinking water, have had to take days off work. This is for the people who've lost business because the beach is covered in sewage. So these CEOs, I feel like it is inconvenient for them, but they are causing a public nuisance.
And have you ever been challenged yourself about making a citizen's arrest?
In what sort of way do you mean?
By people who don't think it's the right course of action.
To be honest, no. I've had so many messages from people saying, thank you for doing this. We can't swim in the sea. We've lost business. We've got sick from our drinking water. So there's a huge amount of public support for this. And I think the question is, should the companies be taken back into public ownership? And why should these CEOs be getting huge bonuses when other people's bills are going up? It's insane.
And when you have been involved in a citizen's arrest, I mean, presumably you need an element of surprise for the person that you're arresting. But at the same time, you need people to see this happening because that's part of the point, isn't it?
Absolutely. We are dedicated and very committed to non-violence. People's safety is our absolute paramount to us. So we do a lot of training. We talk about scenarios, we role play them, and we do film it. And that is for the CEO's safety as well as ours, because people tend to behave better when they know they're being filmed. Mm.
And do you ever worry? I mean, I think that there just is a very basic difference, isn't there, Isabel, between possibly a quite substantial, burly boss, male, of a water company having a citizen's arrest done by a woman of lesser stature. And I'm trying very hard to word this properly in case people say you could have tiny men and big women. But it might just feel a little bit different, actually, if you are a smaller woman and a larger man or woman is trying to arrest you. There are difficulties in this, aren't there?
Obviously that it's a very different scenario to be surrounded by a group of men. I wouldn't like that at all. And we don't use men for our arrest team.
Right.
It will always be women.
It will always be women. Okay. And have you ever felt vulnerable?
Absolutely. I mean, we don't know how the CEO is going to react. I don't want to get shouted at or pushed or, you know, anything. We're sort of relying on the social contract, I guess. So, yeah, there is a certain amount of nerves there. However, I feel committed and determined to sort of take part in this citizen's arrest.
Sure. And what about the protestation of innocence? I mean, Chris Weston, who you mentioned earlier on in the interview, has said that, you know, he has never committed any crime. And I think everybody listening to this understands that there is an element of public demonstration involved in these citizens' arrests. But you're also making quite a substantial allegation about what somebody has done, aren't you?
Absolutely. And we wouldn't do it if we didn't have evidence and we didn't think that we could give that evidence over to the police. And it is for the police to investigate now.
And how many cases have then followed in an arrest, though, or a charge?
So far the Chris Weston case has got the furthest, but we do follow up with our citizens' arrests and we do hope to bring further charges.
Okay, so no actual charge has been made yet?
Not yet.
Okay. What happens if you've got all of this wrong, Isabel?
I don't think we have.
Right. Well, what if, though?
In what sense do you mean wrong? That they've been doing a great job and there isn't rivers full of sewage?
And no, I don't mean that at all. But I think just for the purposes of the law, what I'm trying to get at is a citizen's arrest is a big old thing, isn't it? And actually what you have to make sure at some point is that there's a justification for making these arrests. So a charge will eventually follow.
Absolutely. We are exercising a legal right to make these citizens' arrests. And I know it's not in the usual way. However, I do feel like it's justified. And I think time will show that this has definitely been a good course of action, I guess.
Well, good to talk to you. Thank you very much indeed for joining us. That's Isabel Rock, who is a climate activist. So no charges have been made against the people who have been under a citizen's arrest, as Isabel is very keen to say, yet. So dossiers have been passed on to the police. Would you ever consider making a citizen's arrest? So not about these kind of issues, but if you saw a crime being committed in front of you and you were the only person there, or the only person capable of making a citizen's arrest, would you?
Well, I'd like to think I'd be brave enough, but I think the honest truth is probably not. Is there... is she still there, Isabel? No. Is there a form of words you're supposed to use? Isabel?
Yes, hello.
Yes, hello. When you're doing a citizen's arrest, what do you say?
You have to say their name, and we say this is a citizen's arrest, and you say the charge is public nuisance. And then we ask them to remain with us until the police arrive.
I see. And they do?
Well, in our current action plan, we make a circle of women around them and we ask them to remain with us. And then so far, yes, mainly. Yeah.
OK, no, it's really interesting. It's very interesting, too, that you only use women, because I guess if it's a male water boss, or indeed any other kind of male, breaking out of a circle of women wouldn't be a good look, would it? Wouldn't work for them. Very interesting. Thank you very much. Almost 3 o'clock.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Good afternoon, and the time has inexorably moved on to after 3 o'clock now. It's Jane Garvey and Fee Glover here on Times Radio until four. And in the next hour, Sir Keir Starmer says Greenland belongs to Greenland. But quite honestly, for how much longer? Plus, we've got our literary salon with Alex Clark of the Times Literary Supplement. And Adam Shaw will tell us how to do that really awful, messy task you've been putting off. No, not declagging the shower drain, getting rid of all that fabric conditioner and hair conditioner.
Stop it.
We're talking about your tax return. Actually, I didn't mean fabric conditioner. What would that be doing down your shower drain? You live in a very strange house. Or maybe it's just me. Here's the news at three. Stuart Willey.
Jane, thank you. Good afternoon. The Prime Minister's urged the whole country to unite in the face of Donald Trump's threats to invade Greenland and impose tariffs on the UK and other European countries. Sir Keir Starmer says the trade war is in no one's interests. Meanwhile, in a letter to Norway's Prime Minister, President Trump has linked his push for control of Greenland to the failure to award him the Nobel Peace Prize, as according to the transcript of a letter obtained by US media. Greg Swenson, chairman of Republicans Overseas UK, told Times Radio the president may be using it all as a negotiating strategy.
You know, the president's always provocative when he starts these things. And you know, that's just his nature. That's his style. You know, go out of the gates, throw a grenade in the room, be provocative. Everybody freaks out for sometimes for good reason. And then things settle down, whether it's a day or a week or a month later. And so I think the outcome of this is what's important to the president.
Spain has announced 3 days of official mourning following last night's high-speed rail crash. At least 39 people were killed as the train derailed, smashing into an oncoming train. Authorities say human error has been ruled out as the cause of the collision as emergency operations in Cordoba continue. The country's Prime Minister, Pedro Sanchez, says it's a painful day.
Que vamos.
We will get to the truth, we will find the answer, and when the origin and cause of this tragedy is known, with absolute transparency and clarity, we'll make it public.
The Duke of Sussex has been watching proceedings at the Royal Courts of Justice as the hearing in his case against Associated Newspapers begins. He and six other claimants, including Sir Elton John, Sadie Frost and Liz Hurley, accused the Daily Mail publishers of phone hacking and blagging personal information. Associated Newspapers denies the allegations. The Prime Minister is to consult on a social media ban for under-16s to see off a backbench rebellion. It comes ahead of a crossbench Lords amendment calling for a total ban comes to a vote on Wednesday. More than 60 Labour MPs want the government to show leadership by raising the minimum age. MP Darren Paffy is one of the signatories of the letter.
When we're seeing worsening outcomes on things like educational attainment, anxiety, mental health, cognitive ability, you know, the role of social media in crime and county lines, all of this, we just have to look and say, look, we've got to do something. It's time to hit the pause button. Enough is enough.
A school has been closed after a man's body was found in the grounds. Police were called to Smesto Academy in Wolverhampton just after 10:30 this morning. Attempts are underway to confirm the man's identity and establish how he died. And a man in his 20s and a 12-year-old boy have been critically injured during separate shark attacks in Sydney in just over 24 hours. Beaches in the north of the Australian city will remain closed until further notice. For a roundup of the news on demand, subscribe to the Times Radio News Briefing on any podcast platform.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the Times Radio app, online, and on your smart speaker.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wickes Kitchens and Bathrooms.
So there is an awful lot of news going on today. If you woke up this morning and couldn't quite believe your ears in terms of what President Trump had written in a letter to the Norwegian Prime Minister about his intentions towards Greenland, you weren't alone. And that is the story that we're going to delve into now. Keir Starmer says Greenland's future is for its people and Denmark alone, despite Donald Trump's demand for it to be handed to the US.
Any decision about the future status of Greenland belongs to the people of Greenland and the Kingdom of Denmark alone. That right is fundamental and we support it.
Starmer's press conference came after the announcement of American tariffs on the UK and seven other countries over their stance on Greenland.
The use of tariffs against allies is completely wrong. It is not the right way to resolve differences within an alliance. Nor is it helpful to frame efforts to strengthen Greenland's security as a justification for economic pressure. Such measures hurt British workers, British businesses, and the British economy.
In one bright spot, Sir Keir did say that he doesn't think that the US military will be ordered to seize control of Greenland. Trump has ramped up his demands for control of the Danish territory this year, saying it's psychologically important to him. Let's talk now to Sir Peter Westmacott, who was Britain's ambassador to the US from 2012 to 2016. Sir Peter, very good afternoon from us.
Good afternoon to you.
I wonder if I can first ask you to use your very best diplomatic turn of phrase to tell us what you think of President Trump saying that because he didn't win the Nobel Peace Prize, he finds himself no longer obligated to think purely about peace.
Well, I was one of those who, when I first saw it, did also wonder whether this was real or whether this was AI generated, because I thought it was so extraordinary, even though we'd already had some nonsensical statements from the president saying that America had been subsidizing Denmark and its allies by not charging them tariffs until now on their exports to the United States. I mean, he's obsessed with tariffs. He seems to still think it's the most beautiful word in the English language. So we've already been warmed up. But when this letter to the Norwegian Prime Minister came in, it was confirmed by the Norwegians that it was genuine. It told us, in a sense, what we knew, which is that he's absolutely obsessed again by the idea of getting a Nobel Peace Prize. And the fact that the leader of the opposition from Colombia gave him hers doesn't seem to be enough. It's a vanity project. In other words, it's not about national security. And I suppose it clarifies, if you like, for the rest of us, some of what we are dealing with. It also shows that there's no sign of him looking to find a compromise or find some way of working with allies on Arctic security of the way in which NATO partners have been suggesting. You know, all that's kind of brushed aside because he wants it for psychological reasons. And I'm afraid it's because he, I think, wants to go down with a legacy of having done something equivalent to the purchase of Alaska or the Louisiana land purchase back in the early 19th century. You know, this is the man who made America not only great again, but bigger again. This is part of it. So how do you deal with that is the real challenge. It is rather extraordinary. It is, I would say, somewhat irrational, choosing my words politely. And the Prime Minister, of course, felt, I think absolutely rightly, that he had to make a response to it. And it's a response which is in total harmony with the other European members of the alliance. So that's the position is clear, the position of principle. The challenge is how do you move on from here? How do you deal with the problem? How do you ensure that this doesn't become a real full-blown crisis? Does he mean it or is he going to forget about it? Is he going to change his mind? Doesn't look like it at the moment.
I mean, he's a man who doesn't like losing, isn't he? So actually in saying this is what I want to do and being, I mean, almost like a child in telling us what his motivation is, which is I want to make myself happy. I mean, it does seem unlikely that he would be able to find a way to back down that would retain that kind of patina of success in his head.
The Prime Minister, who's obviously spoken to the President just yesterday, seems pretty clear that there's not going to be a military conquest of Greenland. Well, that's good if he's clear, because Trump has talked about military conquest, if that's what it takes. If he's changed his mind on that, good. But it seems he's not changed his mind about acquiring this bauble, this additional toy, as you put it, the child who goes into the toy shop and says, I want this, that and the other, and I will not stamp my foot and not stop screaming until I get what I want. So it is a real challenge. I think let's take a little time out. There are an awful lot of people around the world, even some of his normal cheerleaders, who think this is a step too far. There are even some leading Republican Congress people, Senate and House, who think this is a step too far. The Supreme Court of the United States is going to rule sometime. We don't quite know when. Could be as early as this week, but it might be more slowly than that. Is going to rule on the legality of him applying these tariffs. We can take a little bit of time to draw breath, and the Prime Minister can work his magic in private diplomacy and explain to Donald Trump why this is actually not in his interests and not indeed in the gift of the Norwegian government to hand over the Nobel Peace Prize, even if it was so inclined, which I doubt if it is.
Yeah.
So there's a little bit of time that we can work on, but as of now, it is jaw-dropping to see the leader of the free world writing in these terms and making such statements to his NATO allies.
You mentioned magic there, and I wonder how much you think that Keir Starmer has a bit of magic about him. He was congratulated by a man who doesn't usually congratulate him, Jeremy Hunt, who said that he thought that Keir Starmer was the kind of right guy for the job and he would be able to have resolute private discussion with President Trump. Would you be that optimistic?
I mean, Jeremy is not a point scorer. So I saw him say that, and you know, I think he's probably right. The advantage we have, excuse me, is that we have a Prime Minister who isn't about building up his own ego. He's about pragmatic solutions to the problems that the country is confronting. He has convinced himself that the way to deal with Trump is in private rather than to call him out in public. He feels that he has made some progress, whether it's on tariffs or trade or other elements of the relationship since Donald Trump became president, even to some extent on Ukraine, although, frankly, the jury is still out on that. And Trump is all over the place on Ukraine, sadly. So I think he's right to keep that relationship going. Trump takes his calls. They do speak to each other. He doesn't have a huge ego like the president does. And there's some very good conversations going on behind the scenes between our own national security people and the people surrounding the president. So I think all that is well worth trying. Is it going to work? I mean, the fact that the Prime Minister has come out and said so very firmly, you know, this is completely wrong and we are heading into a downward spiral with these tariffs, is a sign of just how strongly he feels about it, and perhaps to some extent of how private conversations haven't yet done the trick with the president. But I think he's right to keep it going. And he's got to think of what leverage he's got to try and persuade the president to think again.
You know America, you know Americans. Trump's poll ratings are low, ISIS increasingly unpopular and very expensive as well at the moment. The economy has not rescued Main Street. How much does this play and how does it play in the minds of Mr. and Mrs. Joe Bloggs, insert American alternative surname, who are watching this unfold?
I think it was the former Secretary General of NATO who came up with a rather wonderful phrase a couple of days ago, saying that he thought this was Donald Trump using Greenland as a weapon of mass distraction from some of the other things that were going wrong inside the United States. In other words, you know, the economy, the growth rates, cost of living, and so on. We've moved on already from Venezuela, it seems. He's lost interest in Iran, certainly for the time being, quite possibly for good, because there was no easy win there. And he's a little squeamish about starting wars and seeing lots of dead bodies on television. I don't think he wanted to get involved in a war to which there was no obvious early end. And so as a result, you've got a lot of brave people lost their lives in Iran, thinking America was coming to their rescue, and they haven't. And now we've got Greenland. Now, is all this distraction activity because of Epstein or because of the economy, because of other things? I can't judge that. What is clear is that very, very few people in America, 4% was the figure I last saw, believe that it's worth taking military action to take Greenland. That's not very many. Even Republicans are not very keen on this policy. So I think there is scope for not so much the rather supine Republican numbers in the Senate and the House, although they've begun to move in a different direction on tariffs and so on, calling him to order. But they just might. There is some time for them to come to their, what I would call come to their senses and realize this is not in America's interest. Public opinion is still, I think, fairly divided. You know, the 70 million people who voted for Donald Trump, I think 55% of them are not too sure about, you know, the policy on Greenland, but an awful lot of them are, generally speaking, still supportive of him and do not hold him responsible for the fact that the economy is doing better than ours, but, you know, not doing as well as he claims, and is making their life in many ways more difficult. So we shouldn't hold our breath about public opinion. But I think people should be looking to members of the United States House of Representatives. Of course, we've got midterms in November, and the Senate, to try to reinstall, if you like, the guardrails which they're supposed to apply to limit executive power. The Supreme Court, unfortunately, has gone, unless it turns out to be playing a very responsible game on tariffs, because he's packed it with sympathetic Republicans. So it is a worrying time that the checks and balances created by the Founding Fathers at the beginning of the Republic are not functioning. Let's see whether Congress can realize that this direction of travel is not in America's interest, not right, and going to be very damaging to the economic interests of America, quite apart from the other issues of U.S. security and the fundamental importance of NATO. Republicans, generally speaking, think NATO is a very good thing. They don't really want to see their president blowing it up.
What about public opinion in Russia? Sometimes that is hard for us to gauge, but presumably Putin's hanging out the bunting, isn't he, over this?
Public opinion, I can't begin to judge. But let's look at the level of the government there, or in China. I think they must be thrilled to bits. This is what they've been dying for. They want to see NATO weakened. That's one of the reasons why Trump, not Xi Jinping in China, by the way, but Trump, I'm sorry, Putin, was very keen on Brexit. He saw this as a means of weakening Europe, weakening NATO. He's thrilled to see what's going on here. And I think there's even been some public statement from Kremlin, more or less endorsing the idea of America becoming more involved in Greenland. So the alliance in disarray, NATO looking weaker, America at loggerheads with its European allies. This is just what Putin wants. And it means that nobody's talking about the abominations that he's committing in Ukraine.
Yeah. You may not be able to answer this question because I'm not entirely sure anybody on the planet can answer this question. But Peter, I'm going to give it a go. You mentioned the speed at which Donald Trump's gaze travels across different areas of discord in the world. So we did have Venezuela. We did have Iran. I mean, it's hard to comprehend, isn't it? That was only 2 weeks ago. And now Greenland. Where next?
Well, it's just 1 year, not quite, since Inauguration Day. And we got three more years of this unless, something extraordinary happens in the meantime. Where next? You know, this Greenland thing is going to be there for a while. And even if Greenland calms down, either because people decide that tariffs are illegal or inappropriate or whatever, or he backs down, because sometimes he does throw these things out and then changes his mind. So we're not entirely sure where that is going. Ukraine is not going away, unfortunately. So I think that is out there for the duration. Iran was a huge story last week, and now, you know, guess what? Nobody's talking about it because of Greenland. I don't know. That seems to me to be quite enough. The Venezuela story, people have stopped talking about. But Venezuela is very much unfinished business. You know, what's going to happen there? He was going to be running Venezuela. He's decided to work with the number two of the number one, who they took out and are going to put on trial in America. The U.S. oil companies don't seem to want to invest in Venezuelan oil production because it's too expensive. You know, there's plenty out there for him to play with. And the thing we should keep in mind is that for the MAGA base, for the Trump political base, this sort of overseas adventurism is not what they voted for when they chose this president. They wanted Epstein files to be made public, and they wanted an end to faraway wars. They're not getting either of those things at the moment. And they got
When do you think that catches up with Trump?
It's very hard to tell. He will say things, and the people who want to believe it will believe it, even if it's not true. I suspect that the reality is the economy and the markets. Now, if the markets start to tank because they think that we're going to have a global tariff war, and then, you know, money is lost by his friends or in some of his own investments, then I think he might think again. And of course, as I was saying just now, it is not unheard of at all for Donald Trump to toss out these threats of horrific high-level tariffs and do nothing about it, whether or not somebody like the Chinese or the Brazilians, as they have in the past, stand up to him. You know, he can move on or change subject. He's got people's attention. He's got them on edge. He's got people talking about him. They're not talking about subjects he doesn't want them to talk about. So, you know, let's wait and see what really happens at the beginning of February when he says the first 10% of tariffs are going to be applied. Perhaps they won't be. You know, perhaps some of the private conversations that different leaders around the world are having with him and the businesses and the markets will make him think, you know what, maybe I don't need to do this. And maybe there are different ways in which I can solve the problem. The difficulty is that if it's really about national security, he doesn't need to have Greenland. And if it's a vanity project, it's going to be very difficult to talk him out of it. Mm. So there's plenty of work still to be done.
There certainly is. That's a delicious British understatement. Thank you very much indeed for your time this afternoon. Sir Peter Westmacott was Britain's ambassador to the US from 2012 to 2016. It is breakneck speed, isn't it? Well, and it's exhausting for all of us.
Yeah, I mean, this time last week we were talking about Iran. The week before that, I think it was Venezuela. I mean, is it going to be the Isle of Dogs this time next week? We just don't know, do we? Terrifying but fascinating, let's be honest, at the same time. Next on Times Radio, has a row over Britain's spies sabotaged a debate over the new Hillsborough law? It's Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wix. The kitchen and bathroom sale is now on. Explore all the sale offers at wix.co.uk or visit your local Wix store.
The Times Radio Assisted Dying Debate with Jo Coburn.
Assisted dying looked all set to be brought into law, but if the bill doesn't get through the Lords by the spring, it's over. On both sides, feelings are strong, and we brought together two eloquent and forensic thinkers to debate it. Columnist and philosopher Kathleen Stock has written a book called Do Not Go Gentle, The Case Against Assisted Death. The neurosurgeon Henry Marsh disagrees. The Times Radio Assisted Dying Debate with me, Jo Coburn.
This Thursday night from 9 on Times Radio and live on the Times YouTube channel.
If you could sail anywhere in the world, where would you go? With Oceania Cruises, our small luxurious ships allow us to dock in boutique ports in 600 stunning destinations. We offer a more immersive experience and a personalized service, creating unique travel memories. From the Caribbean to the Mediterranean and the finest cuisine at sea, it can only be Oceania Cruises. Visit OceaniaCruises.com or your travel agent.
Something unexpected has arrived in Happy Meal. Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles and Hello Kitty and friends are teaming up for the ultimate collab. Joining your little ones on a fun-fueled adventure. Some fun, some food, it's all inside this Happy Meal.
until the 2nd of February from 11 a.m. Includes one pre-selected book or toy while stocks last.
Download the free Times Radio app and listen to us wherever you are.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix. Right now, the kitchen and bathroom sale is on. There are options to suit every budget and every home. Browse all the kitchen and bathroom sale offers at wix.co.uk.
Now, a debate on the Hillsborough law was pulled at the last minute over a row about how much the security services would have to disclose. Now, the law, as you probably know, is meant to prevent cover-ups by forcing public authorities to cooperate with inquiries and tell the truth. The intelligence services would fall under that too, but there was an outcry from Labour figures and bereaved families over a proposed opt-out for them. Let's have a word with Carl Cashman, who's the leader of Liverpool City Council's Liberal Democrats. And it's also worth saying he's a fan of Liverpool Football Club. Mr Cashman, this delay must be, well, is it frustrating or do you welcome it?
I suppose it's a little bit of both, really. I welcome the government's change of tack on the opt-out for MI5 because it's the wrong thing to do, essentially. And I think you'd only need to speak to Liverpool people to know that that's the case. You know, many people in this city are still hurt and are still grieving from what happened in Hillsborough and the subsequent cover-up from that. If we would have allowed this opt-out, the same thing could have happened again. And the whole point of this Hillsborough law was to stop anything like that ever happening again.
It actually shames us, doesn't it, as a nation, that we have to bring this law in. I mean, I must admit, maybe I was just incredibly naive. I mean, I shouldn't be, really. But I would have thought that public officials would tell the truth after a disaster.
Well, you would want to make that assumption about this country, wouldn't you? And in a perfect world, a law like the Hillsborough law wouldn't even be needed. But it's important to mention that in name it is called the Hillsborough law, and that's something that the people of Liverpool celebrate. But actually, it's about much more than Hillsborough. It's about the infected blood scandal. It's about the post office scandal. Yeah. It's about many things that have happened in this country and the legacy of cover-up, and public officials, politicians and anyone in that sector should not be allowed to lie about it because it destroys people's lives.
But the real concern now must be that this never comes into law at all. Is that a worry for you?
It is, and I think initially when there was these murmurs of the Hillsborough law, I mean, let's not forget that Labour came into power and said one of the first things they will do is deliver the Hillsborough law. And then we had a big fight about, was it going to be watered down? We got assurances from the Prime Minister that that wouldn't happen. And then it feels like we're trying to jump even more hurdles as time goes on. So I think probably a big thought in the back of not only the minds of the people of Liverpool, but the minds of people who've been affected by, the infected blood scandal and other scandals are we going to get to the point where this law is enacted? And if the government keeps playing silly buggers with, amendments and other things or other obstacles, then we aren't going to get to the point where we get a proper Hillsborough law.
I mean, I appreciate you're not a member of the Labour Party, but is that really how you see it? I mean, Sir Keir Starmer has his critics, but he does strike most people as being a principled individual. And as you say, this was something that the Labour government had absolutely promised to do.
I think my impression of Keir Starmer is he would probably want to be methodical, and because of his background, as a barrister and criminal prosecutor, he probably sees things from different sides. So that's me as a Liberal Democrat being fair to him. But I also think that he must have seen before they came into power, further down the line, this wasn't going to be as straightforward as he made out. So I think in the first instance, he should have been honest with people. And in the second instance, he should have understood how much this meant to people. So it needed to get over the line, but in the right way. That doesn't seem like it's happening to me at the moment.
Right, but don't we have to be realistic about our security services? I mean, you don't know what they do, I don't know what they do, but I'm probably aware, as I'm sure you are, that they may well have protected me and people I care about because they find out things and prevent things from happening. I want those people to be looked after, and I'm sure you feel the same, don't you?
I think what there needs to be is a consistency. And I think if you have an opt-out or an exception for one political institution, then that can lead to issues with that institution, and that can lead to the institution like essentially, you know, taking liberties. It depends also what you mean by, you know, protection. I completely agree with you that in some instances, you know, I've got no doubt that MI5 have protected me in this country. I've got no doubt that the police have protected me and my community. But do you give them an exception from having to answer to the law or to answer to the people? No, I don't think you do. Particularly when we've seen instances like Hillsborough and what that has meant. I think you need to hold everyone to the same standard, whilst, as you say, making sure that we have a common sense approach to it as well.
So possibly members of the security services, what, they could be anonymised, but they must give evidence. Would you settle for that?
I mean, that
happens quite a lot anyway, doesn't it?
Well, I'm not sure, to be perfectly honest, because I think the more we anonymise and the more we give exceptions, as I said earlier, the more we open ourselves up to those being, as I said, the liberties being taken on those issues. So, you know, you've got to apply that rule consistently. And while I know there's certain lease issues where we, you know, we need to protect someone's identity, I think that shouldn't be at the expense of, you know, people who've been victimised over years. And, you know, these Hillsborough families, I was watching something the other day that said, you know, this happened so long ago now, and these families are still waiting for this justice, still waiting for this law. For that to be the case and for those people to have not been held to account is completely wrong. And I don't know whether you see this, but the police organisation, after the announcement came out about the Hillsborough law, battered back against it and said that they were going to support, you know, the police officers that went through that. That is, it flies in the face of common decency. And I think that's what we need to get back to in this country is, like, as you said, trusting public officials in the first instance to not even have the inclination to lie to the public.
Yeah, well, I absolutely hear you there. Thank you very much. That's Carl Cashman, who's the leader of the Liberal Democrat group on Liverpool City Council. Now, we've got a good guest, haven't we, at this time tomorrow on the programme, somebody who's written a very interesting book. Who is it?
It's Claudia Hammond. So she has written a book trying to help us all using her qualifications as a woman with a very big brain that's looked at brain. She's a psychologist, to try and help us all to overcome our feeling of being overwhelmed.
I think today it's probably quite a good example.
I think it's a very good example. Yeah. And I think when we were having that conversation with the former British ambassador, Sir Peter Westmacott, whose life has been spent in those diplomatic circles, juggling quite a lot of very big things all at the same time, even for him, the whirlwind that we find ourselves in, where you wake up one morning and, I mean, we have the luxury of simply needing to know the detail of a new geopolitical event. We're not at the heart of it. We haven't been threatened with invasion.
Well, not yet.
Those kind of things. I'm the optimist, Jane is the pessimist.
Well, I'm realist.
But it is very difficult to actually get a handle on where that information places us emotionally, because it's not normal. It is not normal to have to think about Venezuela, Iran and then Greenland all in the same mighty way within the space of 3 weeks. And that doesn't even begin to tackle the overwhelm that we feel when we watch so many tragedies being played out on our tiny screens in front of us. And you look at the Spanish train crash today, we will have seen images that will stay with us, and we probably think that we've processed them, but we won't have done. They're all going into a bank. So Claudia Hammond is trying to help us deal with the modern age, which is overwhelming.
Well, we will take a break in the next half an hour from our incessant pursuit of attempting to nail that news jelly to the radio wall. And we're going to open the doors of our literary salon and check in with Alex Clark of the Times Literary Supplement. That's in the next half an hour after the news headlines on Times Radio with Stuart Willie.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Jane, thank you. Good afternoon. Sir Keir Starmer has hit back at President Trump's threats to impose tariffs on the UK and seven other European countries that oppose his planned takeover of Greenland. The Prime Minister says a trade war is in no one's interests. It comes as Donald Trump says in a letter to Norway, he's no longer obligated to think of peace. The Times correspondent in Brussels is Bruno Waterfield.
It's really impossible to overstate the degree of alarm. People are talking about the worst crisis in the transatlantic relationship in living memory. This week is going to be absolutely frenetic. There's talks at NATO. Then on Thursday night, European Union leaders will hold an emergency, a crisis summit here in Brussels. So the stakes are very, very high.
The Kremlin says Vladimir Putin is studying a proposal for him to join the Peace Council for Gaza. That's the US-led body which will oversee the Strip's transitional administration following the ceasefire deal with Israel. 3 days of official mourning are to be observed in Spain after a high-speed rail crash. 39 people are known to have died and more than 150 injured after a service from Malaga to Madrid derailed and hit a train travelling in the opposite direction. And British number three tennis player Fran Jones has admitted she might need expert help to deal with her injuries after retiring in tears from the Australian Open. Don't forget you can set the Times Radio News Briefing as your news service on Alexa.
This is Times Radio.
Imagine a place where you can escape for a day. Get immersed in a world of rooms, inspiration and expertise. Where you can laze in luxury accommodation. And kids can feast from 95 pence. Tickets are free to everyone and include all the attractions. You've just imagined a day out at IKEA. IKEA, the wonderful everyday.
Romantic retreats, luxury beachfront hotels, expansive family villas with sensational sea views. Not lots of, just the very best of. Simpson Travel, the magical destinations you love, the personal service you expect. We visit every one of our properties so we can handpick the perfect holiday for you. SimpsonTravel.com, because your time is precious.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix. The kitchen sale is now on. Start 2026 with a brand new kitchen. Kitchens start from under £3,000. Explore all the sale offers at wix.co.uk or visit the showroom in your local Wix store.
Nicholas is one of our listeners, and Nicholas asked about an hour ago if we could do a little something for him, and that is to do a remix of Laurie Anderson singing O Superman with a little bit of the French Henry IV. Your wishes are command. I think it's what Henry IV would have wanted. I mean, it's the mashup. Everyone, we've been waiting centuries for that. Henry IV of France, he died in 1610. And he'll be, if he has a grave, he'll be turning in it.
I think I can hear it from here.
Nicholas, it was a great suggestion. Thank you very much. Good. And our enormous thanks as ever to Ryan Boyden, because he puts these little bits of magic
and
together.
And he's working while he does it. He's
I know, remarkable. It's incredible, isn't it? He's a dexterous young man.
He is.
It is 25 minutes to four, time to enter our literary salon. Previous Man Booker Prize winner Julian Barnes has said his latest book, Departures, is going to be his last. Let's talk about this with Alex Clark, literary journalist, host of the TLS podcast. She has just reviewed it. You've described it, Alex, and a very good afternoon from the both of us, as a slippery affair. What does that mean?
Well, I guess Julian Barnes is kind of partly known for hopping between the genre. He goes from fiction to non-fiction, little bits of autobiography. He throws in a lot of literary history. He writes straightforward non-fiction sometimes, as in his book, The Man with the Red Coat. So he's kind of mixed all that up in one book. Not for the first time, but as he tells us with an apparently entirely straight nib, it is for the last. This is going to be his last book.
And is that mammoth news in the literary world?
I think it is, but then, you know, I've been reading his books for years and years and years. I remember first reading Flaubert's Parrot when I was at school. So you can see what kind of unbearable popularity queen I was. You know, I was already on that kind of tip when I was a teenager. So, you know, he's been around for a long time and he's written a very wide range of books. It's, you know, latterly we've seen him writing these quite concise novels about characters like The Sense of an Ending, for example, or The Only Story. These characters who go back over their past and find that it's not as they thought it was, that the story wasn't really quite what they imagined it to be. But he's also written a novel about Shostakovich in the last few years. You know, he's written all sorts of things, written lots and lots of essays. He wrote a novel imagining an episode in the life of Arthur Conan Doyle some years ago. So he's an incredibly versatile writer. And I think for that and for the sort of longevity of keeping trying to do different things while recognisably having Julian Barnes's voice. Yeah, I think it is big news.
What's his biggest hit?
Oh, that's a very good question. I suppose The Sense of an Ending was filmed not very long ago. I think it's hard to talk about him without going back to some of those early works like Flaubert's Parrot, which was shortlisted for the Booker Prize and in fact lost to Anita Bruckner's Hotel du Lac, a book we're all still reading.
Okay.
I think I just know that I'm a teacher, right? You never forget anything, I suppose.
Yeah. And I think you're having the last laugh, by the way, Alex, in terms of, you know, maybe at school being, I'm sensing, slightly kind of set apart by your literary passions and now you're earning money from it. So where are those
you
people?
Say I was chief librarian.
Okay.
Well. And I went out with the chess captain.
Okay, I take it back.
Do you know what I mean? It wasn't... people
wasn't just one thing, was it, Alex?
No.
We're building up a picture here.
People weren't coming to me for fashion tips and to know how to comport themselves at the disco. That's what I'm saying.
Okay, but you know how to use the word comport. So again, I think you've had the last laugh.
Yeah, I've got the last laugh. Yeah. You're so right.
The Oscar buzz is building for Hamnet, isn't it? Which is the film adaptation of Maggie O'Farrell's novel. I wonder what you've made of it. And a lot of people, when a novel goes to be a film, Alex, say, is it true to the book? But actually, does it matter if a film is true to the book? Isn't it meant to be a bit different?
I think films and books are two entirely different things, and in a very sort of fundamental way, an adaptation can never be true to the original because it is a different medium. And if it's a sort of laboured, you know, a frame by frame reenactment of a paragraph or a chapter, then it's usually lifeless, isn't it? And so I think that they have got to have their own life. What you're talking about is a kind of fidelity to the spirit of something, to the intention of something. If you entirely transform it, then yes, you are left thinking, well, why didn't you just write your own story? It has to have something of that. And in this case, I guess what really got people about Hamnet was that sense of the private, emotional, concentrated lives of people we think we know, that we know of, but this untold story of a personal tragedy.
Yeah. Do you know what I really loved was the fact in both the book and the film, but in very different ways, it really stays with the complete mystery of grief, which I think maternal grief and paternal grief, losing a child can sometimes be a mystery for an entire life. Of course it is, because, you know, you can't explain that loss and that sadness. But for a film and a book to just stay with that thing, I think that's the bit that connects the two genres for me. And in different ways, they're both done very well. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. And that's the point exactly about adaptation, isn't it? You have to have that connection. It can be a kind of filament connection, but it's got to be an unbreakable one. There has got to be something that carries over from one piece of art to the other. And I think you're right about Hamnet. You know, there is a solid kernel of intention, and that's what gets carried over. Yeah.
For people who go to the cinema and think, oh, I really want to read more Maggie O'Farrell, it is worth saying that her books are so diverse in their topics, aren't they? Mm. So if you're thinking that she writes period drama, she doesn't. She writes all kinds of stuff.
All sorts of things. So I picked out a couple and I thought, you know, this is staying with period drama, but it's very different. The book that she wrote after Hamlet, The Marriage Portrait, came out of three or four years ago, which is it's both a sort of literary history in a way, because it takes a Renaissance woman, a noble woman, who dies very young and probably under nefarious circumstances, who appeared in a poem called My Last Duchess by Robert Browning. And it kind of brings her to life again. And it is about essentially women who were sold, very, very essentially sold, power brokered, marriage brokered, very, very young, and how they can endure through art over decades and centuries. But it's a very compelling novel. And then I also thought, if you wanted to read again, this is about endurance through very difficult circumstances. She also wrote a memoir called I Am, I Am, I Am, 17 Brushes with Death, which is about her own experiences of frailty and illness and those of her family. But it's very compelling.
Yeah. If you just want to read some of her cracking stories, I think she's just a great, great storyteller.
She is.
I would recommend her first one, After You're Gone, which is about kind of 20-something, late 20-something love. Set in London, absolutely brilliant, and Instructions for a Heatwave, which does what it says on the tin, and it is set in that 1970s heatwave, isn't it, with the melting pavements. Again, I think of North London, somebody will correct me if I'm wrong about the postcode, but they're just brilliant, brilliant modern novels, and I think... Yeah. What would you recommend? Sorry, Alex, I'll come back.
The autobiographical one about the encounters with near misses, yeah,
which
with
is
death.
I Am, I Am, I Am.
Yeah, yeah. I found that actually quite disturbing, because there's a really, I'm sure you remember this, Alex, the encounter that the young Maggie had with Jimmy Savile. Do you remember that bit?
Yeah, absolutely. It's that sense also of just looking back on a past and seeing it come into a kind of some focus that you couldn't possibly have thought of at the time.
Yeah.
And realising that your life again is a kind of kaleidoscope, isn't it?
Are you one of those people, Alex, who was a bit underwhelmed by the film? As I confess I was, and I feel almost embarrassed to say it.
I really enjoyed it. But I am not a weeper at films.
No.
And I think if I'm not...
Well, he went out with the chess captain, so, you know, you don't sound like a weeper.
Do you know what I mean? I don't always like to feel things in front of screens. So I think, if you know what I mean. I think I'm much more likely to cry kind of... a dog having a sore paw than a really clearly, obviously, you know, emotional situation. I'm much more likely to react to that imprint. That's a kind of personal horses for courses, I suppose. But I do know what you mean. I thought, you know, the acting was magnificent, and I'm sure it will get a lot of plaudits. And it looked very, very beautiful, didn't it?
Yes. I think I just thought I'd like it more. Anyway, Fiona.
Yes, I know. But that is one of the problems, isn't it? Yeah. When we think we're going to like something more than we eventually.
Well, this, by the way, has been discussed on Off Air with Jane Fee. Yeah. I think it was last week, though.
And also, just nothing is ever going to take away from me the greatness of Maggie O'Farrell's writing. Mm. So I almost find all the Hamlet film stuff at the moment just a bit of a distraction. I don't mind if, you know, something tips up on daytime Channel 5. You know, that's an adaptation of her book, as long as people are still reading the books. I think that's all that matters.
Yes, I know what you mean exactly. And there are many to choose from. One of the others that I had picked up was The Vanishing Act of Esme Lennox, yes. I think is a really great book. So.
Yeah, I mean, just the title, Alex, is amazing.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
Very quick word about something you wanted to recommend for any budding writer.
Oh, yes.
What a great idea, actually, because lots of people, they turn over a new leaf in the new year and they say, OK, this is the year that I'm going to write something. So what should they read?
So there is a new book out by Elizabeth McCracken, a novelist and short story writer, American. It's called A Long Game, Notes on Writing Fiction. She has played a long game. She's taught it as well. But it is basically do not listen to any of the previous guides kind of territory. You know, don't worry if people say write every day, but you don't write every day. She says writers essentially write every day. She does anyway, because she harnesses the power of her own self-loathing. And that's the kind of tenor of the book. You know, it's saying, fine, you can read, you know, you tape up all these notes saying, write what you know, show, don't tell, here's how to tell a third person, but that do not follow the rules, because that is not how to become a writer. So do not be hard on yourself.
Okay, that sounds really good. So that is Elizabeth McCracken's A Long Game.
A Long Game. And worth mentioning that she and Anne Patchett, who I bet we all have read and enjoyed, Anne Patchett is the only person Anne Patchett shows her manuscripts in progress to. So look, she must be getting something right.
Yeah. Cool, cool. Thank you very much indeed, Alex. It's always lovely to talk to you. Alex Clark, you can find as the host of the TLS podcast. We were also talking about Julian Barnes' last book, Departures. We were talking about all of Maggie O'Farrell's novels.
Yeah.
I would honestly start with the first one, and if you like it, you're laughing. You've got eight others to come.
Nick wants to recommend Julian Barnes' book, Pedant in the Kitchen. Fun, says Nick.
Sounds good.
And Mark says, whenever he's overwhelmed, he channels his internal Bill Nighy.
Oh.
That's not a bad method of approaching life in the 21st century, is it?
Not bad at all.
There'll be more advice from Claudia Hammond, who's our guest on the programme tomorrow afternoon at this time. Now, are you one of the millions doing your tax return, or thinking about doing your tax return, or procrastinating generally about your tax return? Well, our personal finance man, Adam Shaw, is next. He can tell you everything you need to know. It is 12 minutes to four. It's Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wix. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Times Radio Breakfast with Kate McCann and Stig Abel.
My goodness, there's an awful lot of news going on at the moment. We'll bring you all you need to know from 6 o'clock with Times Radio Breakfast.
Yes, what's next in the international row over Greenland and NATO? Our leaders, William Hague and Kezia Dugdale, will join us to pick through the day's news.
Times Radio Breakfast with Kate McCann and Stig Abel.
Tomorrow morning from 6 on Times Radio.
Download the free Times Radio app from the App Store or Google Play today.
It turns out you can please all of the people, all of the time. Garden games for the kids, a separate cottage for the grandparents, a private chef for that special occasion. Simpson Travel, idyllic Mediterranean holidays that everyone will love. We take care of the details so you can enjoy the moment. SimpsonTravel.com, because your time is precious.
With over 50 years' experience, at Fidelity, we believe there's a difference between investing and being invested. Investing is having access to guidance, tools, and expert insights. Being invested means feeling confident about your future. Investing is choosing from a wealth of investment options. Being invested means focusing on your long-term goals. For ISAs, pensions, or advice, be truly invested with Fidelity. Go to fidelity.co.uk. Your capital is at risk. Terms apply.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
It's that time of year. 12 million people are busy attempting to finish their tax returns. Might just have finished, or they're still putting it off. Is this you? In which case, you really do need to pay attention. If the tax return isn't sent in by the end of the month, you will get fined, and you might also end up paying penalty fees. So, who has to fill one of these out? Because not everybody does. And what's the advice on doing it as efficiently and as easily as possible? Here is our money man, Adam Shaw. First of all, not everybody has to do it, so we don't want everyone to panic.
No, if you've, you know, just employed by a company and have no external employment and don't earn a lot of money off investments, so if you lead a fairly straightforward financial life mm-hmm. and you are taxed at source by your employer, you're fine.
OK, but what if you've got a little rinky-dinky cash ISA and you maybe put more money in than the limit of 20 grand or whatever it is?
I mean, I'm not sure you can put more money in than the limit, but if you have an ISA...
Don't look at me.
No, it's, you're always going, well, how does the system work out?
What have you done? Share with the group.
You certainly shouldn't have done more than that anyway. But no, the clues in the name with the ISA. I mean, one of the lovely advantages of an ISA, despite whether it's a good investment or not, is nice and simple. It is tax-free. And there aren't many.
Well, you're fine then.
You're fine. Absolutely fine. So if you've got ISAs, you are fine.
That's why you get them.
That's why you get them. So not only do you not pay tax on them, but you don't have to have the worry of all this tax return. But if you own shares, if you're buying and selling stuff, if you've got a side hustle, all of that, then you fall into
this net. Well, the side hustle is interesting because lots of young people have got little things on the go. Mm-hmm. I mean, that might just include, I don't know, flogging a few bits on Vinted.
Yeah, so you get a special allowance of £1,000. It's called the trading allowance, although I think colloquially I heard it, lots of people talking about it, is the Vinted allowance. And it's exactly that. You're allowed to earn £1,000 from a bit of business on the side, and they're not worried about that. I think partly that's not about generosity. It's about it would probably cost them more to track you down than they'd get off the money. So you are allowed to have that, and you're allowed to earn a little bit off investments as well.
How much?
Well, it depends. So it used to be a lot more. It was £12,300 a year back in 2022. It is now £3,000 a year. That's your capital gains tax allowance. So if your shares have risen by £3,000, that doesn't matter. It's if you've crystallised that gain. So if you've sold shares and made a profit of £3,000, then CGT applies, and then it gets a bit complicated because you get charged 10% if you're a basic rate taxpayer, 20% if you're a higher or additional taxpayer on that profit. And if it's a property, not your main home, because your main home is tax-free, but if you sold, I don't know, your country, your house, or weekend house,
country
or
estate, you know,
your country estate is what I sort of meant. Sorry, I forgot what company I'm in. Your country estate, 18% if you're a basic taxpayer, 24% if you're a higher or additional taxpayer.
Okay, and you must declare all this.
Yes, you must declare all of this.
Let's go back to the vintage thing, because I'm conscious of our younger audience.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Let's say they have earned £1,200.
Yes.
So what do they do?
Well, I mean, it's
so many of them won't know about this.
No, this is why I'm here.
Right.
It's a public service, Jane.
Yes. I'm just trying to think how many Times readers are on Vinted flogging £1,000 worth of stuff, but go for it, yeah.
There's a wrinkle in that, but let me answer your question first of all. It is one hell of a pain to do this, especially if you're talking about 200 quid or more. But Them's are the rules, I'm afraid. And also, I tell you what's awful, I think, about this, especially in that sort of case that you highlight, is HMRC are just terrible, to be honest. I mean, you try and call them and get any help or guidance, good luck to you. There was a case, a sort of a hearing in front of Parliament, which claimed, it showed 44,000 customers were cut off from the phone after they had been waiting an hour. Because what happens is you wait an hour and then the HMRC things just cuts you off after an hour. So you then go back to the start. And in fact, people said to them, are you doing this deliberately? And the HMRC had to defend themselves, going, no, we're not deliberately rubbish. We're just inadvertently rubbish. Because the accusation was, are you trying to be so bad people just don't call you and they go online? And there is an HMRC, perhaps, I would say the least interesting YouTube channel. HMRC have a YouTube channel with lots of videos on how to do stuff. I've seen a couple of them. I don't think they're brilliant, but they are there for your help if you want to go see that.
Okay. The trouble with this programme is the listeners will pitch in. So here they are.
Yes.
Rosie says, Vinted now automatically tells HMRC if you've sold more than £1,000 worth of stuff.
Well, so there we are.
Right.
I mean, you know, obviously, look, absolutely, no joking aside, you need to obey the rules.
Of course.
You need to obey the rules. There is another thing, though, that, as you say, and Fee said, you know, people just may not be aware of these rules.
No.
And that isn't a defence in law. But if you're a couple of hundred pounds more than the allowance, somehow doubt that would be...
You're not going to go to jail, are you?
No. And you probably don't know it. And it's hard and it's complicated, but you've got till the end of the month and it can be complicated. So it's worth not doing it the night beforehand.
Right. Perhaps you've suddenly become somebody who's made a few quid.
Mm.
You need to register, do you?
Well, yeah, you should have registered already. So you need a unique taxpayer's code. It's called a UTC. You should have got it back, I think, in October. If you suddenly realise, look, this does refer to me, I am relevant here, and you haven't got that UTC, you should try and contact the HMRC as soon as possible. I would do it in writing so you can prove you've tried to be a good person about it.
So you can email them.
You can email them, and I'd keep a copy of that. How quickly you'd get any response, I don't know. But at least it shows that you're trying to do the right thing. And of course, the deadline here is for online. You now have to do this online. If you're going to do it in good old fashioned paper and pen, you've long missed that deadline. I think that, again, was the end of October.
Right, OK. If you miss the deadline altogether, so January becomes February, and you still haven't done this, and you know that you need to make a payment, however small, what happens then?
You get an automatic fine of £100. So, again, in your case, well, not in your case, but in the case that you showed me,
really got
£1,200. Of course, you've only got £200 to declare.
Yeah.
You'll get a £100 fine. So that's, I mean, out of proportion. So there's, regardless of how much is at stake here, but plus on top of the fine, you could get actual penalties on the unpaid tax. So it can very quickly start building up to rather big penalties.
There are benefits. If you have been making pension contributions, you might get a little present back.
So there are two types of pension. If you just work for a company, and again, it's basically called net pay arrangements. So the company sorts out your pension, they take it off your salary. You've probably not got anything to worry about. It's more those who are running private pensions, where it's called relief at source. And especially if you're a higher rate taxpayer, then you need to fill out the tax return. You really do. I mean, you will benefit from this. If you fill out the tax return, you will get a tax benefit because, of course, pension contributions are made tax-free. You've made it not tax-free, and so you'll basically get a tax
rebate.
You've
made that pension contribution out of income that has already been taxed?
Yes, exactly that. So Company X pays you £100. You go, I'm going to chuck all of that into my pension. Well, actually, you'd earn 120 or 140 quid, but tax was deducted. So you really want that tax back. Now, to get that mechanism working, you have to put that on your tax return.
Well, actually,
but that is for those with private pensions, really. If you're working in a company pension where it's called net pay arrangements, again, unlikely to be of concern to you.
OK, and crypto, because lots of people have got a bit of Bitcoin or something else.
Yeah, and lots of people thought they could get away with that. I think that's become such a big deal. I think there is now a new part of the tax return which highlights crypto. And it says, and they've got a special division going, they want that crypto tax, please.
Have you written about this, and where can people see it?
It's on themoneydoctor.tv. I've written it all up there, and links to the HMRC site. So lots of links there which may help.
Yeah, I think didn't we try to ring them a couple of years ago and we didn't get through?
Well, we did. It was at the height still of on the hold. Complaints. Yeah. Well, we dialed in, didn't we, before we started the interview. The whole interview just whilst we were kept on hold, and we kept it running under the programme. I think we weren't answered for 37 minutes.
Well, that, as I said, I know loads of people waiting an hour and then get cut off.
Yeah, it's not good.
No.
It's not good.
Adam, have a lovely week. See you next week. Thank you very much. Who do we want to thank today?
Rosie Cutler, our producer, our tech op, Ryan Boyden. John Pienaar's next.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thank you, Fee. Thank you, Jane. At 4 o'clock, I'm John Pienaar, and this is Times Radio Drive. Here are the headlines. Keir Starmer says the future of Greenland belongs to the people of Greenland and Denmark alone, and billions of pounds in university research fundings to be diverted from soft subjects to focus on future technologies. And on another portentous day, we're looking at what is at stake and how the Western Alliance is responding to President Trump's threats over Greenland. I'll be talking to a former number 10 comms chief, to a man who was the lead at the Foreign Office and to a leading Trump ally. And we're going to, of course, get you up to date with the tragic train crash in Spain.
This is Times Radio.
And here's the news with Stuart Winnie.
John, thank you. Good afternoon. So Keir Starmer says he doesn't think Donald Trump is serious about taking military action in Greenland. The Prime Minister has criticised the President's threat of 10% tariffs if Denmark and European allies don't allow him to take over the island. Former Foreign Secretary Lord Owen, David Owen, told Times Radio, a tariff war may be the only option if Trump will listen to nothing else.
There are coercion techniques available to Europe to use. The French are saying at this very moment that we should be using them. And I think that the only way it will bear in on President Trump, in my view, is when America actually feel the effect. So I think he will have to respond, but it will only be when he sees the American economy actually affected.
It comes as Donald Trump says in a letter to Norway he's no longer obligated to think of peace. Asked by reporters a short time ago if he'll use force to seize the territory, the US president said no comment. European leaders are warning that the threats to 8 members of NATO could have consequences for the alliance. Oana Lungescu is a former NATO spokeswoman, now with the think tank RUSI. She told Times Radio this is a serious crisis.
Just as the United States remain crucial for the defense of Europe, including of the UK, Europe is also absolutely crucial to the defense of the United States. It's through the North Atlantic that Russian nuclear submarines and indeed intercontinental missiles from Russia would go to the American mainland.
Here, and billions of pounds in university research funding is to be diverted from soft subjects to focus on future technologies. Ministers think pushing UK research and innovation funding to areas like quantum computing and biotech could boost economic growth. Grants to research councils covering areas such as art and humanities will be cut by up to 40%. Times Radio understands that the Conservative leader has called a meeting of her MPs tonight after losing two to Reform UK. Kemi Badenoch has warned that anyone undermining the party will be dealt with firmly. Shadow Cabinet member Andrew Rossendale has followed Robert Jenrick in joining Reform. Spain has announced 3 days of official mourning following last night's high-speed rail crash. At least 39 people were killed as one service derailed, smashing into an oncoming train. Authorities say human error has been ruled out as the cause of the collision as emergency operations in Cordoba continue. The country's Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez says it's a painful day.
We will get to the truth, we will find the answer, and when the origin and cause of this tragedy is known, with absolute transparency and clarity, we'll make it public.
The Prime Minister is to consult on a social media ban for under-16s to see off a backbench rebellion. More than 60 Labour MPs want the government to show leadership by raising the minimum age. It comes ahead of a crossbench Lords amendment calling for a total ban, which will be voted on Wednesday. And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times Radio News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. John Pienaar at Drive on Times Radio.
Hello, I'm John Pienaar with Drive on Times Radio. Thanks for joining me. Don't panic, keep calm and keep talking. That was Keir Starmer's advice and British policy today, essentially, and sensible advice it may be as we stare into the abyss of mutually assured economic destruction and the death of the Western alliance opened up by the shocking ambition of Donald Trump to take possession of Greenland. NATO and Europe, including Britain, are now trapped in an abusive relationship with a wildly irrational as well as dangerous and unpredictable partner. And if that's an unfair or unreasonable way to describe President Trump and his US administration, please tell me what's unfair or unreasonable about it. Send me a text or a tweet. Now, let's assume the Prime Minister is wise to keep his powder dry and refuse to escalate the confrontation by threatening retaliatory tariffs. Maybe Trump can be persuaded to back off from economically hammering 7 European NATO partners, including Britain, who deny his claim to own Greenland. Maybe. There is a mocking acronym in Washington, TACO. It means Trump always chickens out. And he did back off from tariffs against China and Brazil. There is still time. Maybe. But what if he doesn't? Will Starmer and Britain join in the massive retaliation by the European NATO partners the president of the Macron of France is threatening now? Or could Starmer be the middleman and peace broker, maybe do a side deal later when the trade war kicks off? But where would that leave Starmer's talk of solidarity and principle, of standing up for what's right? It would look a lot like betrayal of principle and a retreat from painful deterrence in the service of self-interest, wouldn't it? Can you make sense of what we're seeing? Can anyone, a crisis tearing the West, a looming conflict with no winner, although when I say no winner, I should mention the obvious fact that there is one, Vladimir Putin. Make sense of that if you can. And send me a text, 87222, start with the word Times, or a tweet to @TimesRadio. Now, as European diplomats and leaders wrangle about their options, meeting and preparing to gather at the World Economic Forum in Switzerland,
And as the phone lines burn across Europe and across the Atlantic, I'll be talking live to high-level diplomatic and political players on both sides of the Atlantic. And you'll hear the best analysis you will hear anywhere. This story is moving. Who knows how it's going to develop, even as we're on air. Stay with me. Let's find out together. First then, the Prime Minister saying he doesn't think Donald Trump is serious about taking military action in Greenland. Speaking this morning, Starmer was clear in his support for Denmark.
Any decision about the future status of Greenland belongs to the people of Greenland and the Kingdom of Denmark alone. That right is fundamental and we support it.
He was also pretty clear the UK was not looking to escalate the situation.
The UK and the US are close allies and close partners. That relationship matters profoundly, not just to our security, but to the prosperity and the stability that people here depend upon. Under President Trump, as under previous presidents, we're determined to keep that relationship strong, constructive and focused on results.
That's Keir Starmer earlier. I want to welcome now to the programme Karin von Hippel, who is a former US State Department official and who also used to head up the Royal United Services Institute. Welcome back to the show, Karin.
Thank you, John. Nice to be back.
Always good to have you here. Can I just, first of all, if I may, just put this to you, as I'm sure you are a patriotic American. President Trump, Karin, threatening to hammer NATO allies with punitive tariffs for opposing what would be an illegal takeover of an ally's territory. This is deeply damaging to the standing and the moral authority of the USA, as well as to the Western alliance, Karin, isn't it?
Yes, correct. I totally agree with you. And I think the only thing you missed out on in your introduction was that China is also quite happy about this. Both Russia and China are quite happy for the Western alliance to, you know, become much more fragile. It's already frayed because of Donald Trump. And so, yes, it's certainly not good for the United States. And I even think longer term, if you had a different U.S. leader, there would always be the threat of another Trump-like character coming back. And so the Brits and Europeans